Today I want to combine a couple of ideas into my talk. I think these are important. I've spoken about them before. One is remorse, and the other is appreciation. So today's talk really is about remorse for not appreciating. In Christ Returns Reveal Startling Truth, there is one section in one of the later letters that says remorse, remorse, remorse as a necessary process that we need to go through in order to elevate our spiritual consciousness. I've been thinking that meant feeling remorse for some of the things that we did. And if you know, we committed a crime or we hurt somebody or something of that sort, we would be required, on one hand, to experience remorse. And I thought of remorse as being the harvest that we have sown. So if we're going to reap what we sow, and remorse is the equivalent of emotional pain for what we have sown, maybe that would satisfy the law of cause and effect. By experiencing remorse, we would be willingly embracing our responsibility for the harvest. But now I'm thinking a bit differently. I think there's a great opportunity to look at remorse from the standpoint of things that we did not appreciate. It's pretty clear that people feel valued and validated by being appreciated. And it's an important concept. I think when we appreciate, it makes us more open, more receptive, more magnetic to the same kind of energy that we just finished appreciating. So we are really benefiting ourselves by expanding our openness and willingness to bond. And if you looked at appreciation, you can recognize it is not rejection. It is, in fact, bonding with whatever that object is that we are now appreciating. I think praise is different than appreciation. I get emails from Healing Codes clients and other people who are grateful for some of my input, either over the telephone or via email. And I've been taking those things and putting them into a folder in my email that I have labeled praise. But now I'm thinking, they're not praising me. You know, oh, you have a nice hairdo. They're not praising me. They're expressing appreciation. So I actually have that folder mislabeled. They are appreciating whatever energy input I have provided. When I was growing up, I didn't learn to appreciate. I think there were a lot of things I did not learn, some of which is because I'm a male, but also in a family of origin that has a lot of people, the training that one receives is necessarily going to be diluted unless those parents have tremendous management skills and can provide that sort of training and tutoring either by themselves directly or by other resources which they could afford. But I think there was another couple of elements there. One is some sort of sense of entitlement, you know, that I was either entitled, and that was my point of view. And when you're entitled, you have a tendency to be dismissive. I don't want to generalize that. I'll say that seems to have been the case with me. When I was like, oh, okay, I'm royalty. I deserve that. So there's nothing really required in terms of my appreciation or my giving back to that. But there was a flip side to that as well, where I didn't expect much. And because I didn't expect much in order to protect myself from any kind of bad feelings, I would cop an attitude. So if I think I've come to this conclusion that people, specifically myself, if you can't perform, then you cop an attitude, which is not very productive, but it's the way we deal with that level of insufficiency. And maybe like a child, I made everything about me and not about them. I was number 5 out of 7 children, but I didn't really spend much time thinking about the turmoil that my parents were in or my siblings were in. I basically thought about myself. Last night, getting ready for bed, I have a couple of beautiful bookcases in the bedroom. All of a sudden, I noticed a book on the top shelf on the right-hand side. And it was a book about the building of the Panama Canal. And this is actually what has inspired today's talk. That book was given to me by my mother. She knew and had visited me when I lived in Panama. I was in Panama for 4 years in the military, and I loved it. And she came and visited, and she loved it. So she discovered this book. I never bothered to ask her where she got it, but last night I opened it and recognized it was copyrighted 1913. That's a whole bunch of time ago. So when she gave it to me, thinking that I would be interested in it, and it was about a wonderful time in my life, blah, 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 I just accepted it with no appreciation. Thanks, Mom. And that was it. I've never read it. I saw a bookmark in it last night when I looked at it, maybe 6 or 8 pages into it. But I never really expressed my appreciation to my mother for her thoughtfulness. She knows books are really important to me, but I didn't reciprocate and appreciate that she knew that, and this was an indication of that caring. I think we have a great opportunity to be able to look at the people in our lives and see if there are things about them that we can appreciate. And I think it's a given. The answer is absolutely. We can find something to appreciate. On the one hand, we could say that parents teach us using one of two methodologies. This is how to do it. This is how to live a life. This is how to be a parent. This is how to be a man or a woman. This is how to be in a relationship. This is how to fill in the blank. That's one methodology. The other is, this is how not to do it. This is not how to be a man. This is not how to be a woman. This is not how to be in a relationship. This is not how you want to be a parent, and on and on and on. So those two things, those two approaches to teaching us, we can, okay, I got it. But if we fail to appreciate either side of that, we missed a lot of the value of the lessons they were teaching us. If we only experience, wow, the pain of this is how not to do it, and we didn't even get the fact that it was a lesson in how not to do it, we just saw it as malfunctioning of somebody who was emotionally or mentally or physically impaired, and then felt bad about ourselves because, you know, we didn't have parents that qualified for Ozzie and Harriet status, we missed a great opportunity. When I think of my mother, one of the thoughts that came to me many times as a child, because my mother was a registered nurse, if any kind of injury occurred to me or my siblings, and again, I thought mostly about myself, I knew I could go home to the ER. My home was an emergency room. And I used to say this to myself many times. I didn't know how a child lived if their mother was not a nurse. Where do you get the confidence that you're going to survive whatever it is you just did to yourself by falling out of trees and falling off bikes and, you know, stabbing yourself with a knife in the leg because you threw it wrong and a gazillion other things? How did a kid live if they didn't have a nurse at home as their mother? Like, wow, that's... boy, it must be scary for those other kids in my neighborhood or the childhood friends that I had. So I appreciate it. I'm not sure I ever verbalized the comfort of knowing that. Talk about feeling safe and protected. Like, wow, when you have an ER room, an ER that is for you anytime you want it, wow, that's very reassuring. That leads to a great deal of confidence and trust that things are going to be okay. My father was an attorney, didn't like being an attorney, but one of the things that I appreciated about him is he was, as was my mother, very well spoken. They put a lot of attention on that sort of thing. And my father was a good dresser. Right? You got to go to court. You can plead cases and stuff. You want to show up well-dressed. So he always was wearing suits and ties and nice shoes, and he really paid a lot of attention to that. And I realized that later in life, my older brother, myself, and my younger brother, we all were kind of clothes horses. It was really important to us to have really nice suits and nice shirts and nice ties. And we got that imagery from what he wore, and also because before, when we had like religious education, confirmation, and First Communion and stuff, we'd get all dressed up for that sort of thing. And that was a big deal. That was a big deal. And it's nice to have that. But I appreciated my father because he was a wonderful teacher. When he wanted to explain stuff to you, you were going to understand it, simply because he could make concepts understandable to little kids, to big kids, to anything. He wanted to be a college professor, not an attorney, but his father forced him into that career rather than letting him go on to higher education. So when it came time to explain anything, and here's a guy that could cut hair, he could handle cutting meats and stuff like that, because his father owned a meat shop when he was a kid. And he could tune and work on automobile engines, and he could paint, and he could do all kinds of things in the house as well. So from a wide range of capabilities, you know, we would tackle all kinds of projects around the house. And it's like, oh, yeah. So a person could, you know, wear really, really nice suits and then come home, change, and then do these other things that involve using your hands for any number of different activities. That was cool. That was cool. One of the great influences in my life was my older brother, John. John is 2.5 years my elder. A year ago, he celebrated his 70th birthday. And so we had a big party for him. He told me well beforehand he was not going to come to it. And I think everybody in my family of origin had bad feelings about birthday parties. When we were 8 years old, everybody had a birthday party. That one time, with the exception of my sister Patty. My sister Patty, my mother skipped over her, and it was incredibly painful for Patty because of that. But John had a birthday party when he was 8. I had one when I was 8, and the same was true of the rest of the kids. And I didn't like mine. He didn't like his. So he told me beforehand, I will not be around. I'm going out of town. I will not be there for the birthday party. So no problem. We're going to have it anyway. And so we had it. And I took pictures and arranged things and got people to tell stories about John and so on. And I converted it into a DVD of his birthday, which I presented to him a couple of weeks ago, basically on his 71st birthday. He was such an important influence, and continues to be that, actually, that it's very easy for me to appreciate him. And that 70th birthday DVD was really my attempt to express appreciation and to some degree, to deal with the remorse that I had for not appreciating him all those many times. He was my hero. He was my mentor. And frankly, he was a trailblazer. When you have an older sibling who is just a few years older than you, that does certain things and breaks through certain areas, in terms of sports and other activities, it makes life a lot easier for the person who follows right behind. And that made a real big difference for me. So he was real helpful in a lot of different ways. And really, looking at that, it was like, yep. He's still alive, as is my younger sister Anne. So there's no reason for me not to express my appreciation when these two are alive. I don't have to wait till they die like I've done with my mother, father, and three of my older sisters. In my family of origin, there was a lot of talk about sports. My brother and his friends, my father, would talk about sports. We had all kinds of newspapers and magazines. We used to get three newspapers a day come to the house, sometimes four, every single day. Books were all over the place. My parents read, we read, and you just go, wow, this is really, really cool. This is really cool. Because there was a lot of emphasis placed upon education, upon language, upon vocabulary, literacy, and thinking for oneself, and being willing to think. So you just go, well, as compared to, you got to follow this rule. That's not how we were raised. We were allowed to think, and we were allowed to talk about various things. And to, even today, that is a hugely important value for me. When you think of those experiences, you go, oh, yeah. All of that, in those cases, was how to do it. And I certainly appreciated it. I'm not sure I ever really verbalized it to my parents to let them know that I thought they were doing a good job, or even to my siblings, for that matter. But any boy who grows up with three older sisters is at a distinct advantage over other people. Because when you're 12, 13, 14, something years old, and you don't have a clue about girls, and if you've got three older sisters, you can quickly get an idea about girls. Well, I could go, Patty and Mary or Daphne, what about, how do you, what do you do, what does this mean, and on and on and on and on and on. So it's wonderful to have those kind of resources in life when you're growing up. It's wonderful. Pretty easy to appreciate. I was wondering about the framework that one could look at. Let's say each one of us wants to sit back, determine how we can appreciate people in our lives. Well, I'm a fan of the 12 worlds model that I created. I figure these different levels or different areas of activity in our lives are an indication everything that we do is going to fit into one or more of these areas. The spiritual world, the mental world, emotional, physical, family, career, financial, social world, leisure world, community, political, and maintenance world. Those 12 worlds, if you want to get a high value, good sense of accomplishment or effectiveness, when you look at a particular activity that you're involved in and you recognize it falls into two or three or four different worlds, you go, wow, no wonder I feel like I got a lot accomplished. I think that's one of the reasons. But we could look at each one of these worlds with regard to various people. And I clearly owe an amazing debt of gratitude, and I have a lot of appreciation for my mother. I've mentioned this many times before that when I was 6 years old, going to my first catechism class, we'd got let out of first grade. We'd walk a block and a half to the Catholic hall next to the church for catechism. That's there I heard that my three best friends, two Protestants and a Jew, were going to hell because they weren't Catholics. And when I came home crying, and my mother asked me why, and I explained, and she told me, that is not true. What they taught you is not true, and don't worry about it. And she put on a coat and marched down to the church to tell the priest that if any layperson or any clergy ever taught Costello kids that nonsense again, they would never see another Costello in church. And it was that standing up and clarifying that and protecting me from that harmful information. First of all, an incredible distortion, an amazing falsehood that was not going to provide any kind of comfort to a child. It was only going to result in suffering. And now, on the other hand, I could understand that a layperson who, at that point, was the parent of one of my classmates. So if I was 6 years old, this woman had to be 30 or so. To believe so strongly in that nonsense, they had to be suffering in fear of religious dogma. So the fact that my mother stood up for me and straightened that out and made it clear to me what was true spiritually was fantastic, fantastic. And for a person to have that is, I feel so advantaged by that. Turn me into a doubting Thomas if I wasn't one already. You know, I recognized perhaps even before that that adults say things that are not true. They say things they don't mean. They say things they don't know what they're talking about. And so I basically have been challenging any form of authority ever since. In 1969, I appreciated that my mother called me up when I was on leave from the Army and invited me over where she and one of my older sisters and my younger sister were doing automatic writing. That 5 days or 5 evenings after the kids were in bed and sleeping was so reassuring spiritually. It was life-changing for me. Again, it was another one of these. My mother put a solid foundation of spirituality that I could stand on that I don't know how other people could do it if they didn't have experiences of a similar nature. A few months later, she sent me in the mail books about Edgar Cayce, which was the beginning of this exploration of a greater depth of reincarnation and what's possible in Edgar Cayce teachings and readings and so on. And the door was wide open. Anything could be considered. When I was 12 years old, my father wanted me to learn how to drive. I didn't want to learn how to drive, particularly when he was drinking. So we had a Volkswagen Bug, so 4-speed, right? And manual transmission. It's going to teach me how to drive. So he's drinking heavily with a bottle of vodka, and I'm trying to drive this thing, trying to figure out left foot from right foot, and, you know, 3 pedals, 2 feet, that's confusing to me, and 4 gears, and upshifting, downshifting, on and on and on, and then you have to add in the signaling. Like, whew, that's a lot of stuff. I only have 2 legs and 2 feet and 2 arms. I don't think this is humanly possible. But we would go to parking lots along the beach where there were no people there, and my father would start praying extemporaneously. He just starts talking to God, speaking out loud, as you know, and I'm waiting to get hit by lightning. Up to that point, I knew we had to memorize prayers. You could talk about, the Our Father, the Apostles' Creed, the Hail Mary, the Glory Be, but, you know, just talking to God, like, and he said, yeah, this is actually better. It's actually better because it's more sincere. Well, I knew then, and I know it now, that if anybody ever interrupted me in the middle of one of the Catholic prayers that, in theory, I had memorized, sorry for interrupting, continue from where you are. It's like, I can't, I have to start all over again. I don't know it well enough to be able to stop and start. And so my lips made noise, but they really, for me, didn't have any kind of spiritual content or emotional involvement. They were just noises that my lips made in response to what priests and lay people and nuns told me I should do. So the fact that my father told me I could pray like that, I have loved, since I've been an adult, love making up prayers, love spontaneous, extemporaneous prayers, just because I feel like it, just because I can. And that was such a gift. It scared me at the time it was being delivered to me because of ignorance. You know, I'm thinking God up there throwing lightning bolts at people he didn't like and maybe, I don't know what, M&Ms to people he did like. I don't know what he was doing for the people he did like. But I certainly was afraid to be in the category of non-likable people. If you look at all the different things in the mental world where you've been influenced by your parents, by the intellects they gave you and the other things, how they expressed that, for me, the Sunday afternoon or Sunday dinner conversations, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody would sit down and all kinds of topics were legitimate conversation. And they were conversation. One person would talk and then others would add in and back, it would go back. And real respectful, real thoughtful. It was like a class, not only in etiquette, but in idea sharing. And it was fantastic. We used to talk about extrasensory perception when I was a little kid. So here's an 8 or 9 year old, 10 year old kid listening to these kind of conversations about what was possible. And most people on the planet were trying to figure out if this concept even existed. But we knew it did because our Daphne, my oldest sister, used to answer the phone before it rang and started to speak to and address the person who called before they introduced themselves. And she would know other things before they occurred, contrary to expectations. So we knew this stuff was real. There was so much beyond what we could see or perceive with the five senses. And to have an understanding of that as a little kid, whew, that is such a fantastic gift. That is such a great cause for appreciation. But I'm not sure I ever verbalized that. If you were to look at the emotional state, emotional world, and think of certain gifts that you would have gotten that you now can appreciate if you took a little bit of time to do that, is this idea that things can get better, things can change, things can be made to improve. That hopefulness, that faith, that possibility is different than the situation that other people may have experienced. If you even got a glimmer of that possibility, we can grow that seed thought into anything that we want. And sometimes this stuff came from our family of origin. Sometimes it came from the parents or other people, parents of friends, you know, the neighbors. Somebody might have said something, a teacher who might have seen a potential in us that other people didn't see or were too busy to notice or we didn't hear. And you look at that sort of thing and you go, yep, yep. That sense of possibility, that sense of possibility that got planted in the soil of our consciousness is really ours for the caretaking today. We can appreciate that it was delivered to us. It got received, may have been dormant for a period of time simply because we haven't taken the time to look at it and bring it to life by adding energy to it, but it is there nonetheless. When you look, if you grew up in a family where you had an opportunity to care for people, I did, and I didn't take advantage of it, but my siblings, much to my good fortune, did. Caring for somebody else and learning about that is a mighty good thing. Is a mighty good thing. Those kind of lessons really prepare us. Now, my mother was, when she was in her nurse mode, was like a saint. Real caring, real nurturing, real quiet, real confident, calm, you know, blood spurting out of a wound didn't faze her. So if it didn't faze her, it didn't faze me. You go, oh, wow. But we have those kind of experiences, and if we would look for them, I think we can mine them. We start sifting through the experiences in our lives, through the inventory of events, through the inventory of images that we've acquired over the course of our lives. We're going to find a lot of gold. And one of the things that involves, or I would say characterizes gold, is things that we can appreciate. We can appreciate. If we learned how to do this earlier, if somebody took us by the hand at 2 or 3 or 4, and let's appreciate this, the color, the smell, the taste, the consistency, the whatever it is, sunsets and the warmth or the cold or the snowfall or the wind or the rain or the trees or the leaf. A gazillion things were sitting there waiting for us to appreciate them. But people in the survival mode, guess what? Appreciation is not on the list. Not on the list. It's about survival. So as parents, as children, and now as parents to our inner child, now we have the responsibility and the opportunity and the right to go back, oh, you know what? Do over. I want to go back in time and look at this sort of thing. I want to go back and find things to appreciate. And as we find these opportunities to appreciate in our lives of what we've experienced and what others were doing and what the others were doing for us, then we're going to be so much more appreciative. And we can even get to the place where we can appreciate ourselves. And then from this moment onward, we start to look and look around for things to appreciate. The weather, the you name it. Pretty much everything. So many different areas within each of the worlds, the physical, and that you can go back to. My mother one time protected me from a sexual predator that was in the nearby neighborhood. She came and took me out of that person's presence. It was a son of a family that we knew. I said, no, you've got to stay away from that guy. That he's not really like a normal person. You know, I thought there was something odd about him, something different about him. And he's like, wow, I was protected. I was protected. My mother worked the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift as a nurse. So before she got home at about 7:15 in the morning from the hospital, my brother John had already started cooking breakfast for his three younger siblings, me, my sister Anne, and my brother George. He would cook eggs, he would cook pancakes, he would cook various cereals, oatmeal, wheatina, cream of wheat. He would put all that stuff out there. He would get everything ready, and it would be on the stove by the time our mother walked through the door. That's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. On the 70 birthday DVD that I mentioned earlier about John, our sister Anne spoke specifically about his willingness to cook us breakfast, and maybe even eagerness. He certainly rose to the occasion. He used to do other kinds of cooking too that have become family traditions. Apple cake was his specialty, or one of them, that everybody, I mentioned that to him earlier this year. I said, oh, that was great for those three younger kids. Three younger kids? The three older kids. The three older sisters, they loved it whenever they used to make me make it for them. Hey, John, come on, make the cake. So he was legendary throughout the family for that. And when you have those kind of things to fall back on, and we do, we all have those. We're like, oh yeah, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. I think there's some value being in a family. That's the family world. Not only can you, if you've got siblings, if you're an older child, the only child rather, I think there's got to be some advantages in terms of attention. But from what I see of only children, they don't have a fight. And if you don't have somebody to fight with, brothers and sisters, I think you're at a disadvantage. Not that fighting is a good thing, but it's a way of learning how to accommodate your own needs and somebody else's needs. And you learn over time that there is some sort of way to negotiate that doesn't end up in bloodshed or tears or physical pain. In a large family, you can be or feel neglected because there are so many kids. I've thought of that. But one of the upsides of neglect is freedom. When you're neglected, you're not on a short leash, when you're not tightly controlled, I'll say, you can pretty much do whatever you want. If I were talking about the community world, we lived in a very small village, which is a great place to grow up. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody knew Acostello because we all looked alike, with the exception of one sister who had dark hair. Everybody else looked like they could have been twins. So, you know, you couldn't get away with anything, and you were, by virtue of that, you were protected because, you know, like, you weren't going to be anonymous in a little village. It was like wearing a sign of who you were at all times. And so if you everybody knew you and knew your parents, it's like, okay, this is not a good place for committing crimes. It was even safer for us because of who my parents were. My father was an attorney and a police justice at one point and involved in politics. And my mother was the nurse, or a nurse. And we got away with stuff. We're white. That's a big advantage in a small town. Even in a place like Long Island, it is, So that was a real advantage just to have that. Back in our day, the real crimes, if you will, were drinking a beer or smoking a cigarette. And further up the island, this is how we refer to it, closer to New York City, the western part of Long Island, where Queens and Brooklyn were, temptation and problems and conflicts and drugs and other things, crime, were prevalent. Where we were, hardly at all. So that is a fantastic place to bring a kid up. And I couldn't wait when I graduated from high school to get out of there, thinking it was too small and everybody knew everybody else's business. But there is a safety that comes with that. It feels limiting, it feels controlling, it feels stunting. And from a business standpoint, in a lot of ways, it can be. But when you go back and look at those places, they become very, very popular. And high-end nowadays, we're the new Hamptons. And you're like, wow, I never appreciated that. But with a little bit of time, we can appreciate it. Some years ago, how about 20 or so years ago, I went to Martha's Vineyard to do a site survey where an executive meeting was going to be held for the corporation I worked for. And so I was checking it out and making sure the facilities were adequate. And it was nice, and I went around Martha's Vineyard, and it was like, wow, this is beautiful. This is beautiful. This is really nice. This is, wow, what a great tourist place. And it dawned on me, it is exactly the kind of place I grew up in. It's like, wow, I got to get a new point of view. Instead of denigrating it and wishing I were not there, I've got to figure out a way to appreciate it. I've got to see this village like a tourist would. It's got high value. It's wonderful. And it goes on and on and on like that. When I look back, in one of the early books that I came across was Tom Sawyer, right? Huckleberry Finn. Like, I used to go fishing as a little boy on a Sunday morning after going to the early mass, get a fishing pole on my bicycle, ride down to a dock. I'd be the only kid there. They would be adults, 6, 8, 10, 12. And I would go fishing. I would catch a particular fish, a snapper, baby bluefish. And when I got enough of them, I would go home, clean them, give them to my mother. She would cook them for my lunch, and then I would take a nap. That's right out of Mark Twain. And the same thing with clams. I would go clamming and come home with clams. My mother would make clam chowder for the family. Right out of Mark Twain. Man, oh man, that is such an excellent opportunity for a kid to have those experiences. A couple of years ago at a family reunion that my younger brother George wanted to have, and it preceded his death by about 4 months, I took my children and grandchildren out clamming. They hadn't done it before. And it was so fun. It was so fun to have that experience. Three generations of us out there in the water, chest deep, raking for clams. Like, oh, I can appreciate that. They can now as well for that whole kind of experience. And I think it's those sorts of things that we can look around and go, you know what? I'm so blessed. I would suggest that if we look at the letter one of Christ Returns, reveal startling truth, the truth of existence, these items that Christ saw that the divine is always providing for all of its creation, growth, nutrition, nourishment, healing and protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, rhythm, and the law of cause and effect. We can look for those experiences that we had that somebody else facilitated for us as we were growing up, where somebody gave us a pat on the back or a kick in the butt that spurred our growth or made us aware or facilitated us working. I worked throughout high school. You know how it happened? This is how. I was on the telephone one afternoon with my then girlfriend, and the owner of the partner of a drugstore owner came in to her house and said hello to her. Who are you talking to? Oh, Tommy Costello. Ask him if he wants a job. And I said, I will do anything. And this girl said, he would be interested. Ask him to come down and talk to me then. And that was it. I ended up with a job that I worked throughout high school, all the summers, and made, for a person my age, a lot of money, and felt really good and effective at it. It's like, that was provided for. That work was provided to me. I can appreciate how that came about. And I think we all can do that. We can look at all of those experiences and we can mine them for gold. Unquestionably, there are ideas that we've experienced that were the opposite of appreciation. Parents denigrating one another. Parents denigrating other people, ethnic or racial slurs or conversation or demeaning other people. Or parents who created a whole bunch of demands, children, for themselves that they couldn't meet, and then they experienced the stress of all of that, and that didn't put themselves into the survival mode and their children as well. And the fact that parents didn't know how to manage X number of children or their situations that they've created in their lives, and they suffered from that, and the overflow of that suffering might have passed on to us. And some of the rules of life that we learned, some of our misinterpretations, I got it. Life is hardship and struggle, and that's life. And everything is about trying to overcome that. That's clearly not a good rule. Better to be seeing it from a more hopeful, more appreciative point of view. And I think those things are there. And if we went on and made a list of all the people in our lives and looked at them for ways in which they have contributed to our growth right on up to our understanding of the law of cause and effect, and appreciate that we had all those opportunities And we do today too. Opportunities to appreciate. And the more we do, the more opportunities to appreciate we will have. And it's going to be so much easier on our bodies, on our minds, on our health, on our happiness, on our success, and frankly, on everybody else around us. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. See if you can see anything in here to appreciate. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal, loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.